This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn.
And I'm John Davis. People turned out early today. Some even camped out overnight to be at President Donald Trump's Estero rally to drum up support for Republican candidates in the state of Florida. Two seats in particular, the U.S. Senate and Florida governor, are tight contests, and the Republican candidates for both will be in attendance tonight as well.
We'll talk about the implications of Trump's visit, which was announced moments after the last gubernatorial debate last week, with political science experts a little later in the show. But first, John, you went out to Hertz Arena grounds earlier today. What were things like, and what was the mood like there?
Hundreds of people there, probably thousands. Hard to get kind of an accurate count. But folks had been out there since, as you'd said, very, very early in the morning. And the mood was really quite celebratory. Folks really seemed to be in a good mood. And I put together this vox of some of the folks who I met.
Elba Thompson. I live in Pembroke Pines, which is 2 hours from here. I am so excited, and just the crowd makes you excited also. And it's in support of President Trump and his support for DeSantis.
Is there anything in particular that you are hoping to hear from the president at tonight's rally?
I've heard a lot of his speeches, which I sort of think it'll be the same. But I love his love for family, God, and country. Those are big issues for me. Yes, they are. And all the great things he's done so far. I was with him from the beginning, still support him, and will be have my vote on 2020.
Susie. Orlando.
Debbie.
Lehigh Acres.
We're sisters.
Yes.
Is there anything in particular that either of you are hoping to hear from the president tonight?
Everything.
The truth.
He tells
the truth.
He tells the truth. That's exactly right.
And it's hard for people to realize that, but he does. So that's it.
He has a different way of saying it, but it's the truth.
It's the truth. He doesn't mess with words. He tells you the way it is.
That's exactly what
the people want.
Yeah.
Well, the deplorables want that.
Very good, Susie. Very good. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I tell you what. Sitting here talking to people, it's so nice to be able to vocalize how you feel, because if you vocalize, you kind of get in trouble. I mean, they will actually come into your face, I'm talking about the other side, and get after you for being a Republican. So it's just not right. I mean, we're afraid to even wear Trump shirts. I mean, we would wear them here because we know we're safe, but you cannot wear them out because of the other side. And that's ridiculous. And they call us
violent.
Violent? Yeah, they call us violent? No way. Absolutely no way.
Sean Halano, I live in Key Largo. I actually, for most importantly, love DeSantis's commitment to Trump. And that's what brought me out 2 years ago to vote, you know, for Trump. And what I don't like Gilliam is he's exactly what I moved away from in Western New York, in a high tax. Just crushing. I mean, two people are leaving for every one person that moves to New York, and that's a state. So, that social mindset of welfare programs are through the roof, taxes are high, jobs are paying less. There are fewer to come by, and I decided to make less, move down here, and that's why I moved away from. I don't want it following me.
I'm Stacy Preston. I just moved here from Wisconsin to Northern Florida. I'm from the Homosassa Springs area. I'm like a groupie. This is like going to a rock concert.
And is there anything in particular that you're hoping to hear from President Trump tonight?
He usually says everything I want to hear, and he usually does everything he's told us he's going to do. So probably the same type of things we hear from him. And I just feel like he's a president who's really making things happen for a change in our country. Probably the best one in my lifetime. I'm 50, and he's our last hope against socialist takeover, really, as far as I'm concerned.
And you've got an NRA shirt and a pin that says, I plead the second.
I'm not a terrorist. I'm the NRA. Me and that guy and all of us.
My name is Susan Fugere, and I live in North Fort Myers. I figured I'm 66 years old, and this will probably be the last time I ever get to a presidential rally. I've never been there before, and I'm excited to see the President of the United States. He's doing a terrific job, and I just love him to death. I mean, sometimes he's a little off-candid on his Twitter account, but you know what? He just says it like it is, and I think that's why he won, because people are tired of liars.
Yeah.
Yay!
Illegal immigration is my number one issue. Strong military is my second issue. because I have a son in the United States Army and a daughter-in-law in the United States Army. And then I would say health care would be my third issue. I'm in Medicare, so it doesn't really bother me, but I've got grandchildren that it might affect someday. This Obamacare needs to go. I have a grandson up in Massachusetts that lost his health care, who has cystic fibrosis, that shouldn't have lost his health care. He lost his doctor and lost his health care, and they had to go through hoops, 7 months of hoops, to try to find him a new doctor. That was because of the Affordable Care Act.
My name is Lynn Brunatz, and I live here in Estero. I feel like we live in such a divided country today, and it's so unfortunate that nobody will listen to another's views. And, you know, we're here because we love America, and we are protecting America, and we want to protect our borders. We don't want chaos in this country. We believe in the law. Well, my son lives in Columbus, Ohio, and he said that he cannot put the sticker on his car because it would be trashed. Yeah, and that's really sad. What does that speak of the left, of people who don't believe in freedom of speech? I want him to address the caravan that is coming here, planning on getting into the United States. I understand he has a couple options, which he hopefully is putting in place, and that's what I want to know if he is. Putting them in place. I understand he's going to bring the National Guard to the border or the military to the border or both. And I also understand that he is thinking about closing down the border, which I think is an excellent idea until we finally decide how we're going to handle situations that are out of our control and that are obviously somewhere in Honduras, whatever. I mean, we've got the open borders crowd. We've got, you know, which creates total chaos.
My name is Steve Spurgeon, like a surgeon with a P. I live in Omaha, Nebraska. I went to Missoni, Wisconsin. A buddy of mine suggested that I go to a Trump rally because I just missed the one in Council Bluffs. So I got in my car with $200 in my pocket and drove to Missoni, Wisconsin. When I got there, I ended up with $30. But I walked out of my car. I had a generator, I had an amp, I had all my stuff just to be prepared. And I went all the way to the front, walked up there, and just started playing my stuff. And the people loved it. So I went from there to, what was it, Murfreesboro, Illinois. And the same thing, but what happened there was powerful because I was about to head to the Trump supporters and I looked back and you had the protesters were at this rally. It's a blue state. And as I was walking towards the Trump supporters, I hear the boots of the riot police coming and they stood across the street from the protesters. So I went back over there. I stood in the middle of the street between the riot police and the protesters and I shared my message with the protesters. I played my song and this is what happened. They walked away quietly and left. Powerful man. So I know that 17 years, I would not be sleeping in my car driving around unless I really believed in what I was doing. And so I'm giving everything I got to try to wake up the people of this country to love each other again, man. That's all. That's what this is all about. It has nothing to do with politics. People are using politics as the foundation for their values, man. And that's wrong. And so I deflect. Yes, I voted for Donald Trump, and then I went back to work because I have bills to pay, you know? But we have to look past our differences, and I'm hoping I can be a bridge between both groups, so we can come back together because we're better together. We're better together for sure. Wake up. In the USA.
John, that was an interesting collection of interviews there. You heard a lot of people talking about division and not liking the division. And, you know, you could have had that same conversation with people on the other side, just change the names.
That's exactly what I was thinking on the ride back to the station, was how much the mood actually reminded me of an Obama rally that I covered several years ago. And it was just folks on the other side, but kind of getting together a big group of people, a big group of like-minded people and kind of – you know, to use the phrase, kind of letting their hair down and not really feeling like, you know, feeling like they could say what they wanted to say and not worry about being challenged by someone.
Yeah, there is always the person that's willing to rise to challenging you. But that was interesting, that last person, the musician. Mm-hmm. Of course, you'd find the musician. And I saw him on the Twitter feed and that you did. You did a tweet, and we've retweeted that at WGCU is our handle there on Twitter if you'd like to see this person. It's interesting, the story that he had to tell about playing music in between the protesters and then Trump supporters, mm-hmm. and how that impacted people by, instead of screaming back, just playing music that was about just patriotism.
Right.
I found that really an interesting story. That was a great guy to get.
There was another man I spoke with there who was not from our area in Florida, and his voice unfortunately didn't get into that piece we just heard just due to time constraints. I could only do so much in the last hour. But he didn't consider himself a Republican or a Democrat, but he was at this rally kind of just making the case for we need to be voting based on issues like water quality.
I didn't think you'd find anybody that hadn't been decided yet.
He actually found me. So I think he really wanted to get his message out there. And so if he's listening, I apologize. I will try to get your voice into something that we can air later this afternoon.
So I'm wondering, how many people could you tell? I don't know. I know you couldn't get like a turnstile head count. But did it feel like there were a lot of people from out of town, or were most of the people there locals? Is there any way to tell?
I was surprised. It was quite a mix. I spoke with one woman who lives so close to the arena. She walked here. And, you know, as in we heard in that Vox, there was a gentleman from Key Largo, a woman from Wisconsin, another woman from Pembroke Pines, somebody from Homosassa Springs up in Citrus County to the northern Florida area, from Orlando. So, I mean, clearly, this is not just a local crowd.
Okay, so this is a rally, but part of the point of the rally is to get people to actually go and vote. Did you hear anybody talking about having already early voted cast their ballot, or they're planning to go on Election Day?
I saw many people wearing their I voted early pins. A woman told me she voted Republican all the way down the ticket. She voted the very first day that early voting was available in her county. So, yes, this is a crowd that is not just here for the rally atmosphere. They're taking their opinions to the polls.
All right. Well, while you were talking with people at Hertz Arena waiting for the Trump rally, WGCU's Andrea Perdomo was just over 2 miles away at the South County Public Library, where Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate Chris King held a news conference. Andrea joins us now in the studio. So what was his news conference about?
King said he felt it was important to point out what he said were lies said by his and Gillum's opponent, Ron DeSantis, ahead of Trump's visiting this evening.
Tonight, the President of the United States will come here to lift up a candidate who has built a campaign for governor based on lies. And we must have the integrity, because so much is at stake for the people of Florida, to set the record straight and make sure that the truth gets out in the days ahead of the vote.
King said that DeSantis told a total of 43 lies during both gubernatorial debates.
And this was a news conference only announced last night. And while campaigns tend to get hectic towards the end, this seems like something that was planned during Gillum's rally last night in Fort Myers, where more than 1,000 people showed up with about 14 hours notice. Did anyone show up for this?
Not many. Other than myself, there's only one other news person there and about a half dozen supporters. Ruth McGregor from the Sierra Club Calusa Group was there. The group has endorsed the Gillum King campaign, but personally, she supports the candidate's position on health care.
He understands the importance of health care, and he knows that that is the number one issue on Floridians' minds.
And, I saw you whenever I was at the outside the Trump rally coming back. And I know we both saw this overturned news vehicle. I didn't really have time to go investigate what that was all about. But what happened there, Andrea?
Yeah, as I was heading back from the Chris press conference, I drove up and I hopped out and saw what was happening. An NBC2 SUV was lying on its roof. I was able to catch up with Tim Klosardis. He's the assistant news director of the station, and he had this to say.
No, it was just an accident. Our reporter was coming back for her live shots this afternoon and got involved with another car.
Okay, is she okay?
Yeah, she's okay. The other driver said he was okay as well.
Yeah, it's good to get that kind of clarification because that's a high-profile corner today. There are a lot of people driving by. People are a little tense, might want to, you know, assume something happened that may not have happened. So it's good to get that kind of clarification. So I appreciate you stopping and checking on that.
Okay, no worries.
And coming up next, we're going to be talking with Drs. Peter Bergerson and Roger Green about the need for President Trump to stump in Florida and where local races stand now.
We'd also like to hear from you, so here's the number to offer your 2 cents, 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn.
And I'm John Davis. As hundreds of people await the arrival of President Donald Trump outside Hertz Arena in Estero, all day today on Gulf Coast Live, we're talking about politics.
And to help us make sense of it all, we have our political panel in place, FGCU political science professors Dr. Peter Bergerson and Dr. Roger Green. Thank you both for coming in today.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great.
And as always, we'd like to hear what you think. Are you still yet to make up your mind on who you're voting for? Do you think it will help or hurt to have President Trump bring a Make America Great Again rally to Estero, Florida? Give us a call. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL.
So I'm going to start off. Dr. Green, we learned of Donald Trump's plans to come to town to Florida just moments after that last gubernatorial debate. Does it seem like he's coming down to help out a candidate that's in trouble?
Well, Gillum has been trending upwards a little bit lately, so there could be some motivation in that regard. Of course, part of it, too, is that President Trump, has always displayed this tendency to go to places where he'll meet with an adoring group of fans, I guess you could say. And Southwest Florida is a reliably conservative audience for him. So I think part of it is because this is the sort of place he would feel comfortable with. But as I indicated, Andrew Gillum has been trending a little bit upwards lately, and there may be some concern about the outcome of the gubernatorial race, although it's still very, very close.
During a press conference just last hour, Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who represents parts of Broward, said that President Trump needs DeSantis to win to position himself for the 2020 election.
Whenever possible, Mr. Trump finds a way to make everything about him. This election is no different. Florida is a key swing state, and he wants DeSantis in place when he tries to wage his 2020 reelection bid, a task that will be much more difficult if Andrew is successfully running this state, and we know he will.
Let's just get a response to that first. I mean, do you think that's the case? Is DeSantis's potential victory in this gubernatorial race, would it be that much of a boon to the president 2 years from now? Or is that a little too crystal ball of a question to really get into?
I think that may not be the primary reason that he's here today, but it clearly in the back of his mind. Roger suggested he loves the feed off the emotion that the adoring crowd gives him. And also, I think he would like to boost the turnout here in Southwest Florida, reliably Republican conservative, perhaps to offset the Democratic stronghold in Dade, Broward, and Miami area.
And I would say, I mean, just to kind of, dovetail with what Peter just said, I don't think that President Trump is a particularly analytical person, particularly when it comes to the long term. And while I think it would be very advantageous for him if DeSantis were to win the gubernatorial race, I think that's at most an indirect issue for him. I think primarily he likes the feeling of affirmation. I mean, if anything, the election of DeSantis, he would experience that as a as an affirmation of him, President Trump, and I don't think it's more the strategic calculations about the advantages of a DeSantis victory in 2020. I suppose that doesn't reflect well on, you know, the sort of President Trump in a way. I'm kind of, you know, characterize him as somebody who isn't a long-term strategic thinker, but I don't think he is.
And last night, WGCU reported on Andrew Gillum's rally in Fort Myers, where well over 1,000 people showed up. Our reporter who was covering it said he seemed surprised to see so many people in an area that we know is predominantly Republican. Were you surprised so many people turned out to a Democratic rally here in Southwest Florida?
I was mildly surprised, not shocked. I think that during the primary, Andrew Gillum showed the strength of personality in addition to the issues that he has touched on and promoted in both campaigns. And so he really, I think, has some elements of charismatic qualities that really brought people out.
So what's interesting is the demographics in Lee County show 43% are Republican, but independents account for a full 30%. And then we have 27% Democrats. Is there any way to know which way independents traditionally go? Do we know that in Lee County?
Well, I mean, we can make an inference about that in terms of, you know, examining historical outcomes in elections in Lee County, and certainly the election outcomes have been strongly Republican. The label independent can cover a lot of territory, and the way the inflection that can have in a particular geographic area can differ from what you might find elsewhere in the country. I don't think we're talking about independents in that regard who are in some numerically significant way poised and ready to flip, you know, make a significant jump over from, let's say, a conservative to a progressive candidate.
And Dr. Bergerson, to piggyback off what you said earlier about personality and charismatic candidates, when I talk to independents, they usually say it's because I don't agree with all the issues and it matters the person's character and the person is the individual. At this point, is it possible for some of these independents to be swayed by a charismatic personality?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And I think what you perhaps will find is that elections are won and lost by small margins. And I think that you will see independence in Lee and Collier County here and perhaps throughout the area move towards the candidates that like Mayor Gillum, partially because DeSantis does not have that same emotional, I think, attraction. And for sure, the candidates for the Senate race do not. Not to take away necessarily from the governor or the senator, but they just are not the type, and that is kind of an asset that Gillum brings to the campaign that will attract margins of those independent voters.
And I think the really significant factor here is going to be whether or not they turn out. I mean, oftentimes the issue isn't necessarily how they feel about a candidate, especially if you're talking about independents in a place like Lee County. It's whether or not they're actually going to turn out. And I think this is going to be – certainly this gubernatorial race is going to be one whose outcome will be determined by – that's going to be determined by turnout and whether or not younger voters, 18 to 29, and minority voters who are an absolutely key voting bloc for the Democratic Party – but who have a tendency not to turn out in the same numbers in non-presidential election years, will they actually be mobilized and turn out? And I think Gillum, as Peter was kind of alluding to here, Gillum may be somebody who's much more effective at getting them to actually turn out and vote in a non-presidential election year.
I suspect that the percentage of the turnout of the youth vote probably will elevate up slightly, but it's not necessarily the percent of the total vote, but it's the percentage that votes for Gilliam or DeSantis. And I suspect that the Gilliam will attract much more of the percentage of the youth vote than will DeSantis.
Can we take a look at the impact of early voting? Because I understand that, you know, with almost a week until the election, we've already broken the record for early voting, at least for midterms in 2014. So obviously each year that that's been available, more and more folks are taking advantage of it. But is there any kind of breakdown as to whether, you know, conservatives or progressives tend to take advantage of it more than others?
You know, one of the things about early voting, at least, first of all, it's a relatively new. In other words, we've only had it for two or three cycles.
Right. That,
and the early voting in the presidential campaign 2 years ago really presented, I think, false hopes, particularly for the Democrats. Because there was a very high early voter turnout, particularly over on the East Coast, which is a heavily Democratic area. And what happened was that the voter turnout, frankly, was not equal to what it had been 4 years previously in a presidential campaign. I guess my point is it's really hard to draw definitive answers to what early voting might show out.
Coming from a purely anecdotal way, I'm looking at early voting the way you look at things like Twitter or the internet. I'm thinking more conservative voters would be slightly less quick to embrace something new like that, like early voting, and maybe more likely to adhere to tradition and going to the ballot box on election day. Whereas I would think, and I'm just guessing here, this is just, you know, from the sidelines. I'm not the political scientist. I would think that younger voters who are more, you know, tied to their job, unable to get away, not retired, might be more likely to take advantage of an early voting scenario. There's no real breakdown as to who is more likely to early vote?
Well, anecdotally, that's exactly the way I have felt in the past. And it's even the way I'm inclined to feel now. But as Peter was conveying, I think this is still relatively new enough, and it's relatively volatile enough in the way it's evolving, the early voting, that you have to be extremely cautious about, you know, kind of, you know, moving from that kind of sense or that anecdotal understanding to any kind of confident prediction. I think that a lot of people, you know, a couple of years ago were making some inferences about it, you know, kind of along those same lines that ended up proving problematic. And a lot of it, again, too, is that it's just relatively new and we don't have decades of patterns to make those inferences from.
I think one of the things that we can definitely say from early voting is it's going to be those that are highly motivated and those who have clearly made up their mind well in advance. And that they're really they really want to get that to the polls, and so what we'll see in the next 4 or 5 days here up until the 6th are going to be those that maybe are not as energized as we would see in the early voting patterns.
Gotcha. And just apropos of nothing, I'm just curious if you two take advantage of early voting or not.
I have.
Yeah.
I actually don't, because I like going in on election day. I actually enjoy that. I like going there and being around people. And I don't know if that makes me a traditionalist or if it just makes me sort of a social animal. But I actually enjoy going in on election day.
I'm the same way.
I may too. You know, I'm from Chicago. You know, you vote early and often there.
So. Well, and also, yeah, just exactly.
Early and often. And we have voter fraud.
Let's talk about that now. I feel the same way. But also, I think there's a practicality to it. And I don't want to discourage anyone from early voting. But just in this midterm cycle alone here in Southwest Florida, we've had a candidate drop out of a race after she was caught lying about her education credentials. We had another candidate shortly after the primary election actually pass away tragically. So I wait until the day just because you never know what's going to happen. But Anyway, as far as issues are concerned, you know, earlier this year, after Parkland, of course, the biggest issue in the state and seemingly the nation was gun control. But that was eclipsed, at least locally, by, you know, the environment, the blue-green algae, the red tide. And have concerns over gun control shifted back into focus since the deadly mass shooting in Pittsburgh we just saw over the weekend?
Well, I haven't. It's still too recent, I think, to kind of have a lot of data to look at. But my sense is that has been resurrected as a high profile issue. I mean, certainly talking, for example, with my students, that's all of a sudden popped back into view. So my sense is that that's popped back into view as well for the rest of the electorate.
I think it raises the consciousness of and particularly here in Florida, the dramatic impact of what happened not only in shootings and that we had in Orlando and other places, the school shootings. But I really think that here at the end of the campaign, what really has stand out in Florida is the personalities.
Yes.
of it. They really have Trump's personality and perhaps the personality of others has really sucked the oxygen out of the air of dominant issues that is driving people to the polls.
Yeah, I agree. That's an excellent point. I mean, in a way, policy issues have been displaced by some of the personalities. And even with respect to the recent incident, you know, tragedy up in Pittsburgh and how that would, you know, position gun control policy debates. In a way, it's ended up being less about gun control policies than it is about the personalities and the response of individuals like President Trump to the event.
Well, you can see how the personality overshadowed the entire thing because the argument almost immediately went past gun control and somebody being able to get an assault-style weapon like this man allegedly had. And it went straight to who's at fault for inspiring this guy to do this thing. So then we get into what we kind of talked about a little bit at the beginning of the show and what a lot of the people that are out there waiting at the rally right now were talking about. And that is the incivility and the inability for people on two different, very different sides of the political spectrum to be able to talk to one another. So what I'm wondering is if this issue of divisiveness, domestic terrorism, extremism, is that going to bring anybody to the center? Or is it just going to cause voters to further entrench themselves back in their corner?
Well, in the short term, it's going to be entrenched. It's going to be division, and it's going to be the caustic approach to it. And unless there is a concerted bipartisan leadership by individuals of both parties, and that it appears it's going to have to come from either the state level or perhaps Congress to diffuse the nature of what I see as the caustic dialogue.
And I concur. I see nothing near term that would lead me to imagine that there will be any kind of tapering off in the level of divisiveness and intense factionalism. I think at times we can even use, you know, some of the language of civility and collegiality and the like in ways that I mean, I agree with the principles that are being articulated, but in terms of the way that's going to play out psychologically among voters in the current political environment, I think it's just those are nice sounding words that are simply going to get no traction with what's driving politics at this point in the United States.
Can I ask each of you guys, if you in political science, is there a point in history when we've been this mad where there are people sending mail bombs and being inspired in this hateful way? When is the last time something like this kind of a tenor happened? Because I remember talking to you a while back and you said, Dr. Bergerson, back in the Vietnam era.
Yeah, 1968. It clearly was a demarcation line for the assassinations, frankly. You know, you had Martin Luther King Jr., you had Bobby Kennedy, you had George Wallace shot, you had protests, the It wasn't at that stage, though. It wasn't the verbal bomb throwing that we see now between opposing political parties. It was different groups in society that were frustrated with Vietnam, that were frustrated with racial division and racial policies and things. But now it's come to the point where the bric-a-brac is between the parties.
Yeah, politics in the United States has always been intensely factionalized and divisive. I mean, there's never been any kind of mythical period in the past when it wasn't. But as Peter is conveying here, what's noteworthy in recent years is the way that divisiveness, intense factionalism, extreme sentiments that used to animate many segments of the public and that would oftentimes produce some pretty severe political violence, that's migrated now into partisan politics to the point where the sort of the core rhetoric that you find oftentimes among the parties is steeped in that. I think that's what's unusual.
I think the public, though, is interested in going back to perhaps the Eisenhower decade, the 50s, and, you know, Mayberry RFD approach.
Well, they kind of evince that, you know, they display that as a sentiment, but then what they respond to in elections seems to be the more divisive, intense rhetoric. So it's kind of like this, you know, sort of this, this is what I claim that I would like to see, but then that's not how they actually behave when it comes to the election. So, yeah. I mean, people are divisive and factionalized and intense and, you know, employ this kind of rhetoric in the political environment because it seems to have been working. Yeah. You know, in terms of election outcomes.
Well, and also there's that fear of not rising to the occasion and then being run over.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sure, exactly.
Today on Gulf Coast Live, we're talking about politics as President Donald Trump is about to make an appearance in Estero. The rally at Hertz Arena, formerly Germain, will host what's called a Make America Great Again rally starting at 7 o'clock tonight. Doors open at 4, but there are already hundreds, probably at this point thousands of people waiting outside to get in, and they've been there since early this morning. We're talking with political science professors, Drs. Peter Bergerson and Roger Green, about the impact Republicans would like to see from a rally like this. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And let's shift gears here a little bit because, you know, while these are two very important seats, and I'm referring to, you know, the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race, there are important things on the midterm ballot. And of course, those are the amendments. The Constitution Revision Commission came up with more than a dozen changes to the state's constitution. And this is just something that has been very unusual this year because of the Constitution Revision Commission. And I just kind of like your thoughts on some of the things that Florida voters are going to be deciding on, both in terms of the bundled amendments and really whether or not the items that are being put on this are things that should be enshrined in the state constitution.
Well, I'll be happy to. Yes and no.
Okay, and we're done.
there's a number of things that, in my mind, that do not belong in this, that are constitutional amendments that do not belong there. There's some that clearly do belong there. I guess I would say, first of all and foremost, would be restoring voting rights for individuals who have been convicted and served their time in a crime. That needs to be removed from the Constitution. Idea of having initiative and referendum decide on gambling does not belong, in my mind, in the Florida Constitution and perhaps others.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan either in Florida or in other states around the U.S. of policy making through constitutional amendments. I think that to the degree that constitutional amendment processes are used in Florida or other states, they should pertain to issues that are more constitutional in nature. There's been a rising, you know, trend in states throughout the U.S., unfortunately, I think, to make policy, non-constitutional related policies, through the amendment process. And we certainly see a lot of things on the ballot this time that are problematic in that regard. But I would agree with Peter. I mean, an example of an amendment, a proposed amendment that is constitutional in nature is the, you know, amendment number 4 that would restore voting rights for felons who have completed their terms. That has a constitutional dimension to it that elevates it far beyond the level of policy. So that's a good example. But most of these others, quite frankly, I take a very dim view of. Certainly the ones that are rather extravagantly and strangely bundled, oftentimes in discordant ways.
Right.
But even
like
some of the others.
And offshore drilling.
Yeah, banning offshore drilling and combining that with a prohibition on e-cigarettes and vaping indoors. I mean.
Yeah, that was an odd one.
Do you think that this is in some way what we're looking at, maybe a symptom of the Constitution Revision Commission being problematic? Because, I mean, these are politically well-connected people. That's how they got those appointments. They're not constitutional law experts.
I think that some of these are amendments that are put on the ballot were a process of compromise in order to get them on the ballot.
Yeah.
And some of them, again, like the supermajority designed to raise taxes, no one likes to raise taxes. But on the other hand, if you put a supermajority into the Constitution, I see the whole tenor of almost all of these amendments as one of being restricting government and one of having a very limited role for the state government. There is a role that should limit the state government. I'm not opposed to that. But some of these, it just would hamstring the ability. You know, what would happen if you had a hurricane, which, you know, we're obviously very accustomed to, emergency comes along? Well, you have to get a supermajority in the General Assembly to raise taxes to address those particular problems. That, to me, is not good government.
And there have been consistent efforts and intense lobbying for many years now throughout the country by organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council to you know, bring about the enactment of supermajority requirements for raising taxes in states. I mean, that's something that's been around for a while. The fact that it would find its way onto the ballot this time through the CRC, I think, is a manifestation of its politicized nature and its responsiveness even to those political interests.
Well, and while some of these CRC, you know, sponsored constitutional amendment proposals have been, you know, going through the court process and the state Supreme Court deciding whether or not they could be on the ballot, I had read about a consortium of state lawmakers who were considering taking steps to just abolish the CRC. Is that something that you think that would likely happen, or do you think this will probably just get swept under the rug and then we'll wait 20 years and it'll come up again?
I don't anticipate that they'll do away with it. They're just not a big enough groundswell. Yeah. And to use what political resources or political acume that some particular group or groups would have to do away with it, the payoff is 20 years down the line. So I don't see it.
I think it's a good statement of principle, but I agree with Peter. I don't envision that there will be some groundswell for that to actually change. And I doubt that people will, you know, key people will in a sustained way want to invest the necessary political capital in trying to bring that about. And there could likely be some it could leave you susceptible to attacks or pushback. You'd be characterized as somebody who, you know, opposes the ability of voters to bring about, you know, constitutional change. So I just think a lot of people will just kind of you know,
a little too risky.
Yeah, a little bit too risky for the long term payoff.
So we had in our newsroom a lot of conversations about, okay, so we're going to do profiles about all these different amendments, and we'll be airing that on Monday, I believe it is, on Gulf Coast Live. We have stories from across the state about each of the different amendments. So if you're interested in learning more about those, tune in Monday from 1 to 2. We'll be talking about all of them. But we didn't know which ones to talk about for a while, because some of them were not going to be allowed on the ballot.
They were in legal limbo.
Yeah,
they were taken off.
So they were taken off. But then
the
mail-in ballots got sent out, printed without some of them. And then the Supreme Court said, yeah, they're back on. So I'm wondering if this would present the grounds for a legal challenge after, if some of them passed or didn't pass, if somebody really wanted to go after it about how some of the ballots that had been printed without some of these amendments even on them.
Well, it could be grounds for a legal challenge, but whether or not the court would sustain the challenge would be another question. My guess is the court would not.
And, yeah, I agree.
One of the bigger issues with some of these amendments, not particularly all of them, is that once they get into the Constitution, state constitutions then become antiquated and frozen in time. And subsequently, they hamstrung the ability of the legislature and or the other officers to function, and that's one of the reasons that the states have oftentimes given up power and authority to the federal government, because their state constitutions just aren't equipped to deal with the issues of the day.
I agree.
Yeah, I think of one I covered in pretty recent years, and it did pass, but it literally pertains to soldiers fighting a war we're no longer in and a housing crisis we're no longer facing.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
just there.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily a bad amendment. It was just, why does it need to be in the Constitution?
Yeah, right.
It's just
yeah.
a statutory change.
And that's the case with a lot of these issues. It's not that they're particularly necessarily bad. It's something that they should be addressed by the state legislature and the governor.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask also about something in regards to the governor's race, and I don't know if you think this is having much impact on how people are making their decision on who to vote for, but the state Supreme Court recently ruled that outgoing Governor Rick Scott is not going to get to appoint the 3 outgoing justices to the state Supreme Court, and that the new incoming governor is. So whoever wins this race and gets to choose those justices is going to have an impact that will last well beyond the 4 years of their term.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask your thoughts on that, and you know what it could mean if Gillum gets to make those selections versus DeSantis.
Well, I think the implications are quite significant. I mean, this, you know, it's always fascinating to see these cases where, and maybe to be reminded of how, you know, executive power doesn't just include the things you would ordinarily think of as the power of a governor or the power of a president in terms of executive actions. It's also oftentimes in a more sustained way the power that you can wield through the appointment of judges. And that's just as much the case for a governor as it is for a president. So I think the implications here are extremely significant. I don't know that that's going to have a huge impact on the election outcome, because I think the difference between Gillum and DeSantis is so significant, the divergence is so great, that I don't think you're going to have much in the way of movement among voters in the middle from one to the other. You know, if we'd had a gubernatorial matchup between, you know, Adam Putnam and Gwen Graham, there might have been the possibility
sure.
for a little more movement like that. But I think, again, here it's going to be so much the turnout issue among certain key constituencies that even an issue like this that has profound significance for what happens in Florida in the years ahead, I don't think it's going to be that significant in terms of shaping the gubernatorial election outcome.
I think it's really interesting what you said just a minute ago about the possibility of shifting in the center part, because when the primaries were over, we were sitting here thinking, oh, we're looking at basically Sanders versus Trump, but in Florida. Like if Sanders had gotten the Democratic nomination, we're going to see kind of like a similar type setup, but, you know, a junior version at the governor level. So it's a really interesting correlation that you drew there as far as people in the center. And I'm wondering what you're seeing comparing the governor's race to the Senate race with Nelson and Scott.
I think there's a fairly significant difference. I don't think there's going to be a great deal of movement among voters in terms of preferences, even in the senatorial race. But I don't think the divergence is as great there as it is with between Gillum and DeSantis. And certainly the conversations I've had with people in different, even in different demographic groups, what I've gleaned from those conversations is that the Nelson Scott race inspires it doesn't inspire the same level of intense sentiments and divisions that I'm seeing in Gillum versus DeSantis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point. And you also, you know, talking about the role of the appointment of the courts, this is something that already has been built into the base of both political parties and both political candidates. What we're talking about now, you know, probably 90 to 95% of the voters, those who are going to vote, have already made up their mind. And so the issue of judicial appointments, that's built in. The remainder that is left to make up their mind or switch, that's not going to be an issue because it's not it is now not at the end of the campaign as one that would stand out.
So we're looking at personality and turnout. That's all the time that we have for today's show. We want to thank our guests, Dr. Peter Bergerson and Dr. Roger Green, both political science professors with FGCU. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Mike Kinnairy and myself and Julie Glenn. Our director is Richard Cinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis.
This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.